behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, the rumors are true. You know what that music means. I'm Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And we are joined today, as always, by our super producer, Noel
the Ghoul.
Noel the Ghoul Brown. That's great, man.
Yeah. Well, tis the season.
Tis the season, indeed, Scott. Today, we are coming to you on the Tuesday before Halloween. So if you're hearing this when it comes out, you're just a few days away from a weekend that some people love and a weekend that some people hate.
Yeah. Thus, the creepy topic for today.
Yes, the creepy topic for today. Before we get to it, though, Scott, I do have a question.
Okay.
Were you, like, an active Halloween trick-or-treater when you were a kid?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as long as I could stay out, and, you know, we're talking, like, pillowcase full of candy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a blast. Loved it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved it when I was a kid as well. You know, I've learned that you can't do that after a certain age.
Yeah, that's true. What's that age? 30?
Well, we'll see. I'll try this year and report back.
Okay.
I'll try this weekend. Yeah. But the thing is that we have, as you guys know, we have looked into true crime before, and we've looked into even spooky urban legends, right? Ghost stories. And because this is the best time of the year to do this, we're going to look at some, I don't know, what do you think the right word would be, Scott, or the right phrase?
I like infamous, but but we've already used that. We've have another show that's infamous cars.
Right.
This is along the same lines. Maybe oh boy.
Maybe the sequel?
Maybe. Something like that.
Dark Cars.
Yeah.
That sounds like a horror movie that would be on Netflix right now.
And I guess this would be a good time to point them to that older episode that was called Infamous Cars, and that was recorded a couple of years ago. I think it was January 29th of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on our website, carstuffshow.com.
And in that podcast, we mention a great deal of infamous cars that were instrumental at some dark point in history.
Yeah, either, you know, they had some type of crime history to them. They were owned by somebody who was infamous themselves.
Right.
You know, just the cars of legend, I suppose, you know. Let's see, who do we have? I mean, we've got so many here that there's no way we can list these, but like the car that was involved in Princess Diana's fatal crash, or O.J. Simpson's Bronco, or David Koresh's Camaro.
Right, the cars of serial killers, the cars where famous people died, such as the drive-by vehicles of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G., of course, the presidential limo for JFK, those kind of things.
Yeah, Ted Bundy's car, you know, the DC sniper's car, Bonnie and Clyde's car. All those are there. There's literally a list here in front of me of about 30 cars that I listened to the old episode and wrote those down, because today we're going to try not to duplicate any of those vehicles in this list. So we're going to make an attempt. But man, I feel like a couple of them I have to mention, but I think we'll just pass it up, because I've got a bunch of examples of cars that were somehow infamous. You know, they were used in crimes, or you know, people did horrible things with them, or horrible things in them. And again, this is all a Halloween type thing. So some of the stuff, and you know, we don't often say this, that some of the stuff that we're going to talk about here might get into PG territory.
Right.
If you've got young kids in the car that might ask some questions or something, we're going to keep it clean. I'm just warning you up front that, you know, there'll be some terms thrown out there of what some of these serial killers did that, you know, maybe you don't want your kids listening to. It's one of those shows.
Right.
Let's call it PG-13.
It's PG-13. And then we'll also talk about not just killer cars, but there's some other stuff out there. I think we mentioned before the cars of some dictators. So we'll look into that.
And one other thing that I think I need to point out is that at the end, there's a different angle on this whole thing too.
Yeah.
And a slightly different twist on this. It's an older article that we'll talk about, but it's about a secret junkyard.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'll say no more.
I think that's it. We're just going to leave it at that. There's a secret junkyard that we're going to talk about at the end. So hang on for that as well.
Yeah, hang on for that part, or fast forward to it, because man, it is a fascinating topic.
Well, don't tell them that, Ben. We gotta have them listen to all of these cars, because these cars have a fascinating history too.
Right. Well, the second part of the show won't make sense unless you hear this part.
That's true.
Is that an okay saying?
You've recouped.
I'm still a few points down. Let's see if I can get back up to even. I feel like we're in Vegas, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, so will you do the honors, Scott?
Well, sure. Okay, we can talk about a type of vehicle in general. And this is an unusual way to start, but think about this. In Nazi Germany, mm-hmm. 1930s, all of the Nazi Gestapo and the French Mafia drove the same type of vehicle. And we're talking about Citroën Traction Avant vehicles. And it's unusual that, you know, they would all kind of select the same vehicle, but take a look at the car. You'll maybe understand what I mean. This is this is like a gangster car, really.
Right.
Now, this is a car that was not really noteworthy for its beauty, but it did have legendary performance. So this is a car that, you know, you could get in and out of town quickly. It handled better than anything else on the road at the time. It had, hydraulic brakes, independent suspension, a self-supporting body. And of course, it was very expensive as well. So, you know, not everybody could afford this, but of course, the French Mafia could. And of course, the Nazi Gestapo, of course, you know, they've got money coming in from, you know where they're getting their money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, interesting vehicle, you know, kind of funny that they would both gravitate towards this one type of vehicle to use for, you know, whatever purpose they had.
Yeah, that's very strange.
So, you know, it got to the point where they would see, you know, the citizens would see these vehicles pull up and they would know that something bad is going to happen. You know, when it arrives, because, you know, one way or the other.
Yeah, but that's a fancy car, Scott. I've got a severely unfancy car.
Okay.
And a pretty dark one. So you always hear those stories about creeps driving around in vans, right?
Sure.
Well, Jeffrey Dahmer, a serial killer and cannibal that we can all agree was quite a creep, he had a blue van that he used to drive around and troll to pick up people.
Oh, boy.
Victims.
This is so fitting, doesn't it? I mean, it fits the stereotype.
Mm-hmm. At the time, it was because he was working for a floral delivery company that had vans, and this became part of the link in the disappearance and murder of Adam Walsh, you know, the 7-year-old whose death inspired the America's Most Wanted.
I don't know if they ever got to the bottom of that, if there ever was any connection or any tie-in with the Adam Walsh case or not. I'm not sure.
They suspected Dahmer in it. He was linked to it,
yeah.
But he never claimed responsibility for it. It doesn't really fit his MO. It's just that the floral company he was working for had blue vans,
yeah.
And a blue van had been identified during the time of Adam Walsh's disappearance.
Yeah, he was abducted from a mall. I believe.
Right.
Well, he was shopping with his mother. He's playing a video game or something like that. And, that's an awful, awful story. But, I've got another one for you, Ben.
Okay.
All right. So this is an unusual one and it's a great car. But it was used in an infamous heist. This is the 1963 Ford Lotus Cortina. And, this is an infamous car that was used by a guy in the 1963 Great Train Robbery.
Yeah. Bruce Reynolds.
Yeah. Bruce Reynolds. And this is in relation to a $7 million cash heist that happened. This great train robbery in 1963. $7 million.
Right. And they didn't get all of that. It's funny. Weirdly enough, I was checking out this one too before we went on the air. So why was this so clever?
Well,
Cortina.
Well, because I don't know the exact reason, but of course it's a fast car.
Right.
And this is the mastermind of the whole plan. He drives that. The rest of the crew used Land Rovers to get away, but they were apprehended.
Yeah. The people who were using the Land Rovers were apprehended. They're the majority of them.
Was there more to it than that, Ben? Was there something that made him even more clever to use the Ford, the Cortina?
Well, I think it's because as soon as they identified the Land Rovers.
Ah, see, he wasn't part of the whole.
He wasn't part of it.
Ah, I see. Yeah. I get it. All right. So he, I think he, made his way to Mexico, right? He escaped, lived in Mexico for a while, Canada, and even France. But then this is so dumb. He returned to Britain for a work opportunity. And, of course, they nabbed him then at that point. But
right.
He did 10 years in prison, and then he was released. And I don't know.
Started playing with his son's band.
Yeah,
Alabama
exactly right.
3.
Yeah, so $7 million, gets away in a Ford Cortina, Ford Lotus Cortina. Pretty smart move on his part.
But it's also interesting there because it makes me think, you know, Reynolds referred to that train robbery, which we could do an entire podcast on, as his Sistine Chapel. And I feel like when he came back, although he was allegedly running low on money from the last robbery, when he finally came back to Britain, it was for the love of the game more so than the money, as strange as that sounds.
Yeah.
he wanted to do another legendary train robbery.
This is like an Ocean's 11 type story, right?
I just.
Hey, do I have that one right? I mean, maybe it's a different.
Is it Ocean's 12?
I don't know. It could be one of those movies, you know, but it's like, just one more heist, you know, just one more, just to do it, for the adrenaline or whatever. Okay. The next one I have is this is again, just a general style of vehicle. And I'll tell you why that it's just a general style, not a specific vehicle.
Okay.
Do you remember the case of the Zodiac Killer?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking
about. Terrorizing California in the mid-1960s, and supposedly the Zodiac Killer was spotted or seen, you know, the cars around the scenes,
right,
in a 1966 Chevy Impala that was white in color.
And here's the problem. Chevy Impalas, white Chevy Impalas specifically, enormously popular in this time.
Yeah. Of the 1966 model, they sold something like a million of them. And I'm not joking. A million of these were out there. So, of course, everybody's calling in tips about who they think the Zodiac Killer is along the way. And because it was such
everybody sees it.
Yeah. Like a vanilla car or whatever. I'm sure that the Zodiac Killer was secretly laughing about this the whole time. You know, like, pulled one over on the police again.
And the Zodiac Killer at the time of this recording remains uncaught, with the cases being declared inactive, a few years back.
Yeah, the San Francisco PD said in, I think, 2004, it went inactive at that point. So, again, got away with it. Got away with it. All right, here's one that if you are a fan of Boardwalk Empire, you're going to like this next one. There was a real-life Nucky that existed in Atlantic City back in the 1920s, and his name was Enoch Nucky Johnson, not Thompson, as they portray him in Boardwalk Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so this character, as you can imagine, if you watch the series, you'll know that he drives around in a very flashy Rolls Royce. It's not exactly like the one that he actually drove, though. He drove a 1920 Rolls Royce Silver Ghost.
Uh-huh.
And they've pretty much got the character spot on the way that he really was. He was that flamboyant. He was the guy that really was running Atlantic City at the time. I mean, the mayor, sure, mm-hmm, doing his thing, but this is the guy that's the one that's supplying all of Atlantic City with booze during Prohibition.
Wow. Yeah.
And what a life this guy must have had. Now, this Rolls Royce had a $14,000 sticker price in 1920, which was
right,
the equivalent, they say, of 50 Model T cars.
Right. And to be specific, if we would like to run the numbers and calculate that, $14,000 in 1920 is worth approximately almost $174,000 today.
Wow. Unbelievable. Now, his salary, or what he was bringing in, I wouldn't say salary because, you know, he was making money in a lot of different places. This guy was bringing in something like $500,000 a year in 1920, which is approximately about $5 million a year. So
this guy was
really, really wealthy. Of course, drove a flashy vehicle, you know, just lived the whole life. I mean, it's unbelievable. And if you watch, you know, what that character does on screen,
mm-hmm,
you got a real idea for what the real Nucky Johnson was like in Atlantic City back in the 1920s. Here's one that we may or may not have mentioned. I just want to say it anyways, either way.
Okay.
Al Capone's car.
Ah, yes. Al Capone's car. I was wondering if we had mentioned that one too, because this car is legendary. 1928 Cadillac sedan. First off, it's beautiful. I would be scared to drive one just because it would be like, I'm a big believer in don't play with things you can't afford to break.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So this
one is not so fragile, as you'll find out, because he added quite a bit to this to make it, more to suit his lifestyle, I guess, right?
Yeah, you're reading my mind, because I was gonna say though, we could get in an accident in this and you and I would be just fine. He has inch thick bulletproof glass.
Yeah, all around. Of course, that's important for a gangster like Al Capone.
Mm-hmm.
3,000 pounds of steel armor plating that he added to the vehicle. He also had secret compartments for, you know, guns and all that kind of stuff. And then he had kind of like trap doors installed in this vehicle where they could, you know, release like tacks onto the road or drop oil onto the road to create an oil slick. It's like a spy car.
Yeah, it had a real police siren in the wheels to impersonate the cops. And interesting thing for our tech fans here, had what is believed to have been the first police radio receiver.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that this car was called into service as well, right?
First civilian radio receiver.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, good point. And this car was called into service because following the bombing of Pearl Harbor, FDR used this car for his own personal vehicle.
Right. Yeah.
Or the vehicle that he was chauffeured around in, rather. Because mm-hmm. it was built so well, so safe, and, you know, had all the stuff that they'd already needed. Of course, they'd confiscated it from Capone at this point, and sent him off to Alcatraz, I believe.
Right. And later, this car went to a private owner, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. It was sold at auction, a British auction, in around 2006, I believe. And, there's rumor that there might be another Capone Cadillac out there somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Do you give any credence to that?
I don't know. Because they say it's in a basement somewhere in Chicago, which, of course, right. is where he operated. They also say that, you know, the building on top of it was demolished, but the basement is still there with this Capone Cadillac mm-hmm. intact. So I don't know. I like to believe that it's out there, but I don't know. I really don't buy into it too much.
Yeah, it seems very plausible that there would be more than one modified car. You know, just because if you're a mafioso at that time,
yeah.
if you're a gangster, you need to have these contingency plans. However,
well, you're flush with cash too.
Yeah. Why not? What's another car?
Yeah. What's another Cadillac?
Right. I mean, how often have we asked ourselves that question?
Yeah.
So it seems to me plausible that there would be a second one, but it doesn't seem plausible that it would have been just left and forgotten.
That's true. That's
it true. Seems like somebody might, it might be somebody's secret car, you know?
Could be.
So let's talk about some dictators, Scott.
Oh, great.
Former and present. You recall earlier we talked about the many cars of the Kim dynasty in North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about the Shah of Iran.
Oh, no, we didn't.
The Shah of Iran, the former Shah of Iran, had such a huge car collection that listing them all would take our episode. We would have to make an episode about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a national car museum in the capital of Iran, in Tehran, and it's made up of cars that were owned by Iran's former rulers. Most of the cars were formerly the cars of the Shah and his family. And of course, remember, the Shah was overthrown and revolutionaries pretty much took all those cars, put them in storage, and made a museum. But most of them are in storage because they can't, there's so many that they can't put them out. The museum's not big enough, is what I'm saying.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So
these collections amounted to thousands of vehicles, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Rolls Royce and Mercedes were his favorites. And of course, if you're a dictator, you have to have a Mercedes, man.
Of course.
It's like some weird rule.
Is it also gold by any chance?
That's a different Shah.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's funny because earlier we were talking about the stereotypes that people might associate with certain cars, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my personal prejudices aside, one thing that seems interesting is that dictators seem to gravitate toward Mercedes.
Yeah,
it's a real thing.
It really is. It's true. I mean, Saddam Hussein had one, of course, that looked just like, was it Jack Nicholson's car that was parked next to at the Peterson,
yeah,
I believe?
Yeah.
Almost identical. It seems like it's a funny thing, but they really do gravitate towards that brand for some reason. Of course, Mercedes limos we're talking about.
Right, yeah. And there's another one here that's actually a pretty nice car owned by a different dictator.
Who would that be?
That would be Benito Mussolini, the proud owner of a 1932 Alfa Romeo Monza.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Not a bad car. Bad
no.
guy.
Bad
not,
guy.
Bad
Great
guy,
car.
Not a bad car. Wow.
Yeah, because he had his own racing and engineering team, apparently.
What?
Yeah. And he also is an Alfa Romeo fan, Scott. He also drove an Alfa Romeo 6C 2300 Pescara Spider.
This is all news to me, Ben. I've never heard of Mussolini and his tie-in with racing.
Instead of a normal chauffeur, he hired a guy named Ercole Barato, a former Alfa Romeo factory test driver.
No kidding. You know,
yeah.
And it seems like, well, I mean, that's one way to go. Sure, that's really cool to do that, I guess. But if he's that interested in cars and that interested in racing, you think that he might drive himself instead of having a driver, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it might be a security thing, though.
Oh, it could be. Could be. And I guess if you're going to have a driver, you might as well make it a test driver.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Saddam Hussein, just for the record, regarding our earlier statement, he had a Mercedes S600 limo.
Oh, all right.
Got to have the Mercedes, man.
Take a look online. You'll see it. It's a pretty incredible car, really. Mm-hmm. We talked about that one at length, I think, for a while. I mean, that and also Jack Nicholson's car.
Was right, yeah. Right.
Okay, I got one here that's it's a little different on this list. This is a Ryder truck. And you might remember this Ryder truck, the specific Ryder truck, from a terrible event that happened back in April of 1995 here in the United States in Oklahoma. This was used in the Oklahoma bombing. Timothy McVeigh drove this vehicle. And, of course, he loaded it up with a mixture of fertilizer and diesel fuel and other deadly chemicals and then bombed the Alfred P. Murrah building in downtown Oklahoma City. And God, it was like 170 people that lost their lives in that thing. I mean, he of course fled the scene, and McVeigh's getaway attempt was one of the shortest in criminal history. It was something like 90 minutes after the bombing they had captured him, and he made a couple of critical mistakes, but he was pulled over by an Oklahoma state trooper who realized that the vehicle that he was traveling in was missing a license plate, on the getaway car. And he was also carrying an unregistered concealed weapon. So, he had a couple of strikes against him right there. Wasn't being too inconspicuous and, ended up, captured very quickly. But if you recall, if you were watching television at the time or reading newspapers about, this event, this whole thing that went down, you saw Ryder Truck, the brand Ryder Truck and photos of that vehicle in particular from the, from the crime scene, just plastered all over the place. So Ryder, I think, took quite an image hit at that point, right in the mid-1990s.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen many Ryders around, actually, in a while.
Well,
they're still around.
They're still around.
I don't see them as often.
Yeah, they're definitely still around. I think a Ryder truck was the type I used to move here to Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah,
huh? I've only used U-Haul.
Really?
Yeah, I guess I'm just, what can I say, man, if it's...
Oh, by the way, listen to our U-Haul podcast.
Oh, right. Oh, man. Oh, that's a weird one.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure people are tired of hearing me say, oh, right. Oh, man. That's a weird one for that, whenever that podcast comes up.
How about this? Let's use a different one that a lot of people might not have heard of. And this is one that was news to me. This happened in 1974.
Okay.
And there was a driver. Her name was, Priscilla Ford. And if you look up information about Priscilla Ford, you'll find this horrible story about what happened Reno, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll just read it from this article here. It says Priscilla Ford had a blood alcohol level of 0.162 when she drove her 1974 blue Lincoln Continental down the streets of Reno on Thanksgiving Day 1980. She plowed through pedestrians going over 40 miles per hour down five blocks of packed streets before she finally stopped at a nearby red light. She drove five blocks. Usually when we hear about these things, it's like an unintended acceleration type situation.
Yeah, or you meant to hit the brake.
Or a confused driver or something like that. They made the wrong turn, ended up in like a street fair or something. This lady drove five blocks that was packed with people. She was on the sidewalk for hundreds of yards at a time. It was intentionally mowing down pedestrians in Reno, Nevada. Now, when it was all over, and I can't believe this low total, she had killed six people, but she had injured two dozen other people. The rest of the people were able to get out of the way.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I know that it's awful that she killed six, but I'm thinking like just six in this five block. That's pretty incredible. Pretty amazing. She, of course, was found guilty in this long trial that lasted for a long, long time. And honest, Ben, this lady was crazy.
It sounds like crazy.
She, I mean, going back, I looked at a little bit of her history. And some of the claims that she'd make, and there's some really, really weird stuff going on in her past. But she was sentenced to death and died in prison in 2005. So she paid for the crime, but it was decades later. And this blue 1974 Lincoln Continental is remembered as the vehicle that she used for this horrible crime.
I don't want to hit the dictator stuff too hard. I just became fascinated with the cars of dictators.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, they're almost all Mercedes, but there is we've got to have time for the, secret junkyard stuff we talked about, but I have to have one more Benito Mussolini car on here, and that is the Lancia Astura.
Oh man, that is a good looking vehicle.
I had no idea that Benito Mussolini was a car guy.
Me neither. I mean, this is all news to me. I mean, the whole racing angle and everything. I mean, man, maybe we do I hate to say it, we'll do a Mussolini podcast. The cars of Mussolini? Probably not. Probably won't do it. How about this? This is the only mention of it that we'll do right here.
Okay, that's it.
Or maybe a sidebar here and there.
You never know what's going to come up.
I guess you don't.
Now, you've got a few more, right?
You know what? Let's laundry list them because I really want to get to the secret junkyard story. So let's just quickly go through these and make it really fast. So not a lot of detail, but we talked about Ted Bundy's Volkswagen Beetle in the first episode, you know, the first one we did a few years ago, he had a second Volkswagen Beetle. So this was one of his cars of choice, apparently. There was a stolen, or I think it was orange, this one. The previous one was white, but he had stolen a Volkswagen Beetle in Pensacola, as in Pensacola, I think, when they pulled him over for driving erratically in this vehicle, and that led to his arrest, or one of his arrests, I should say. Another one is Robert Lee Yates. He drove a 1979 Ford van, and who's a bad guy? He was caught in 1999, and I think he had 16 victims, a lot of which were done away with in this van and a Corvette that he drove. He also drove a 1977 Corvette. 16 victims between 1975 and 1998. Of course, he was apprehended in 99, but he was nearly caught in that 1977 Corvette, but due to a minor misprint on, I guess, the police APB or whatever they sent out at that time, they were looking for somebody who was driving a Camaro rather than a Corvette, and he managed to get away. So he was actually, he could have been caught right then.
Wow.
But they let him get away. Now, the next one would be the Morris Murderers, Morris minivan. And this was owned by Ian Brady and Myra Hinsley. And again, they were known as the Morris Murderers. And this is awful. They were, they had a, what they said is a pathology of killing and disposing of children in the foreboding Saddleworth Moor outside of Manchester.
Wow.
And I think they had five, a total of five young victims between 1963 and 1965. But they made that that type of van, that Morris minivan, kind of synonymous with the Morris murder case. Lonnie David Franklin, who was also known as the Grim Sleeper.
Yeah.
He operated in a 1977 Dodge van. Again, the van stereotype, as we hear so often. He was a California area killer. He was associated with or suspected of having 10 victims between the years of, this is weird, 1985 all the way to 2007. Now, this is strange, because, and they call him the Grim Sleeper because he took a pause of 14 years between murders between the years of 1988 and 2002. And that's really, really unusual. It makes him very difficult to catch as well.
Right, because serial killers typically have a cooling off period. The difference between, say, a spree killer like Priscilla that we mentioned earlier or a serial killer is that a spree killer will typically get as many people in as short a time as possible, right, without a cooling off period. But when we talk about serial killers, there's always some sort of cyclical cooling off. And not to make this too much of a crime show, this is a very dark thing we're about to talk about, but people like Dennis Radar, the BTK killer, he had a cooling off period which would have resulted in him never being apprehended if
then,
he didn't go back.
And then he got so bold as to go back to his old ways of sending clues to the police.
Right.
And technology had caught up to the point where they could capture him based on the clue that he sent.
Right.
So it was really, it was really, that's a fascinating story, by the way. I mean, it's horrible, horrific, but it's fascinating that he thought he could just pick up where he did several years prior, not understanding how they could trace that back to him now at this point.
And there's a question, too, for these people about the cooling off thing. And you have to wonder, in the case of the Grim Sleeper, if this was the same. Apparently, one of the reasons that Dennis Radar was able to abstain from murder so long is because he found another more socially acceptable, I hope you guys can hear the air quotations there, socially acceptable outlet for his sadism, which is he was animal control.
Yeah, weird, huh?
Yeah, so maybe the Grim Sleeper was doing something like that.
Well, I guess we'll find out, Ben, because he was captured in 2010. The trial was scheduled to begin in June of 2015, but as we're recording this, his trial was set to be, it was delayed after, you know, a couple of delays. It was set to begin just yesterday.
Right, yeah, we're recording this on a Tuesday. It was supposed to begin yesterday for our time. Yeah, you're right. It's strange that it would be so far after the murders, right?
Yeah. Yep. And then there's one last one that I want to mention here before we get into the secret junkyard. The Suzuki Swift, of all vehicles, a Suzuki Swift that was driven by a guy named Karst Roland Tates. And he drove this black Suzuki Swift straight towards the Dutch royal family as they were paraded down the streets in Holland. It was part of a celebration. And he was attempting to ram that parade vehicle. And he missed and plowed into the crowd that lined the parade route. and he killed 7 people and injured 10 more. And there's video of this happening. There's video of it actually, you know, when it was going down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the attempts to run over and apprehend him. And he was, of course, I think he's unconscious behind the wheel. And he died the next day of his injuries from that accident. And so no one ever found out the motive behind this. But again, just a horrific thing that happened very recently.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's a question here. We talked about several dark things in U.S. and global history. So it always brings us to a question. What happens to these cars? What should happen to these cars? You know, it's a profound thing. And I don't think there's ever an absolute right answer that will apply to all cases.
No, because take this for instance. Ted Bundy had sold his white Volkswagen to a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about this in the first podcast.
Yes.
But he had sold his car by the time they figured out who he was and what vehicle he's driving to a teenager who, you know, after he cleaned it, of course, he cleaned mm-hmm. the whole thing out. So it was spotless, but they did find some evidence, I think, later. But it had changed hands. So this kid had unwittingly, you know, bought this vehicle from a serial killer. He didn't know, had no idea. But mm-hmm. now that car has been, you know, it's been taken back, and I don't know how that all worked out, but now it's in a crime museum. And, such is the case of the DC sniper car. That's in a crime museum as well somewhere. So these things, they have a second life, in that they can go to someplace like that, a crime and punishment museum or something like that, you know, on display if they have some kind of unusual features like Al Capone's vehicle.
Uh-huh.
It can be bought by collectors or whatever, but most of them are just ordinary cars that are used for horrific things and they're required to be held as evidence. And that's where the secret junkyard comes in.
Ah.
And I love this article, and I encourage you to read it because there's no way we can get through everything that I want to in this article, but it's an older article. It's from the Los Angeles Times, and it was written in a long time ago. It was written in 1998. It was mm-hmm. from July 20th of 1998, but this doesn't really change. It doesn't. It's going to be the same in 98 as it is now, really.
Yeah, it's worth the read.
Yeah, it really is. It's called, and I'll give you the title of it so that you know exactly what to search for. But it's called "In Secret Junkyard: Cars Are Reminders of Infamous Crimes." Now, the thing is that this is a junkyard that, you know, the police know about. Obviously, the crime technicians know about. Some public know about it, but they don't know that those cars that they're seeing are necessarily the ones that have been used in these infamous crimes. And, you know, they were used as a trolling vehicle for a serial killer or, you know, the cars that mow down people in crowds or whatever. They're being held as police evidence. So
mm-hmm.
the idea is that they have to keep the whole vehicle so that if during the court case, they come back and say, we need more samples of the carpet. We need, you know, that door panel to prove the bullet trajectory, that it did in fact travel that way or whatever
right,
the case
right.
may be. You know, there's a lot of different scenarios here, but the husk of the vehicle, the hull of the vehicle is left behind after they've taken all the samples. So let's say that, they need, this is awful, Ben. Let's say in the case of a couple of these, they need to take the cigarette lighter out because that was used as a torture device by a serial killer.
Right. Or they have to take more carpet out for a fiber match.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, stuff like that, or the seats out because they contain blood stains or, you know, whatever, DNA samples, all that
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They remove all the stuff that's really critical initially. Of course, that's all protected. It's all inside. This lot that we're talking about, the secret graveyard of killer cars, really.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Cars of serial killers and horrific things that have happened in these is just left out in the open air. And it's not necessarily bad. It's just that they have to hang on to it for a certain number of years, even after the case is considered solved. So that mm-hmm. they can't crush them. They can't get rid of them. Of course, they can't be sold.
Right.
There's just really, it's kind of like a limbo for these cars until they can be destroyed. And it's the thought of the police that, you know, a lot of people would be better off if we would just crush all these cars. You know, we don't have to maintain them. We don't have to keep them around. We don't have to look at them and remember what happened.
Yeah.
The families of the victims, you know, they're upset by, you know, having that thing still out there. That's where their loved ones met their demise or whatever. It's just a bad reminder. They're just bad vehicles to have around. It's like a bad symbol left behind.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to hang on to these things until they can be crushed. So, you know, they've got cars in this particular lot that they're talking about here. And again, this is in Orange County in Los Angeles. A couple of like really standout examples in that crowd of vehicles is a couple of guys that they call the Freeway Killers. Both of them had the nickname the Freeway Killer.
Right.
So, for example, there's a vehicle on this lot that was driven by a guy named William G. Bonin. And he was, of course, known as the freeway killer. And right. Bonin, I think, operated only for – he was active, I guess, as they call him, between 1979 and 1980. But this guy, the number of victims that he had was they think anywhere between 21 and 36 or more victims.
Of which may just remain officially unsolved.
Yeah, exactly, because this guy was executed in 1996 in San Quentin in California. So what his car is still left behind at this point. This was 1998. So by now that thing has been crushed because they had to wait, I think, 3 years
right
after his death in order to make sure that everything was tied up with this whole case. That's the legal issue with this whole thing is that they've got to keep them for so many years.
And it can be controversial too, because of course, survivors or families of victims don't want to keep this thing around as a relic. You can understand why they wouldn't.
Yeah, now here's an interesting little bit here, and this may or may not be intentional, and this is from the article. There was another vehicle in there driven by Randy Kraft, and Randy Kraft was another guy that they called, oddly enough, they called him a freeway killer, but they also called him the scorecard killer. I think that was another name for him. You know, a lot of them
right.
get these nicknames along the way, which you can... There's weirdness about that,
but
too.
It makes sense that they called him that.
Yeah, I guess so. The number of his victims, this is awful. Anywhere from 16 to 67 victims from this guy and alone. From 1971 to 1983, he killed in three different states, California, Oregon, and in Michigan. And he drove a faded brown Toyota of some kind. And they found on the floorboards, as you know, this reporter was going through there, they found a baseball that had smashed through the window. And it landed on the carpet, you know, the floorboards of this vehicle, right in the exact same spot where they peeled back a piece of the carpet and to reveal 47 photographs of victims. Of course, that had been discovered long before that, but they were saying, is this coincidence or not that there's a baseball in here? Was it like just some local kids playing around and this happened, or was it a victim's family member
a memento or something?
Or was it a victim's family member who was, you know, threw this ball at the car and broke a window out of anger?
Right.
You know, see, these things they're present. They're here. And so this so-called secret junkyard that, you know, a few people know about. Basically, the gist of this article is that they're trying to find a new place to locate it because people are starting to find out about it. There have been some scavengers, you know, some people that are there seeking souvenirs of some sort, some kind of macabre souvenirs from these vehicles.
Yeah, so that kind of security has to be necessary. You know, I've never really considered that for a long time, but these sorts of relics are prized by a certain demographic.
Yeah, strange to think of calling that a prize because to so many, it's something that just needs to be destroyed. It needs to be just put out of sight, completely destroyed.
Stricken from the record.
Yeah, exactly right. Some people feel that they just need to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Right.
Yeah, they shouldn't be around. If I can go see it, it shouldn't be there.
Just stricken from the book. However, there's a compelling case that these things need to exist because, you know, if you think about it, if that car still being around offers the chance for another victim's family to have closure, then ultimately you have to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly right. And you know, as you read this article, and I hope you do go find this article and read through it, it's pretty interesting. There's a lot more to it than this. And as you read through it, you get the feeling that even the police officers, they really don't like going there. It's just a weird place to be because of, you know, what they know what happened in the vehicles. They're familiar with all the cases.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like these awful relics left behind, and they feel that it would just be better off if they could just scrap all of them.
Right.
So I don't know. It's an interesting idea that there are secret junkyards out there, and you know that this is just one instance. This is Los Angeles,
right?
Orange County. There are instances of this all over the United States, all over the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so where are they? I mean, are they, have you ever seen one? I'd be interested to find out if you know of a spot in your town that has something like this, you know?
Yeah, let us know if you have one, because it's strange when you think about how many secret locations are within an hour's drive of where you are right now, probably.
Or in plain sight. I mean, this could be in plain sight and you wouldn't really put it together like, oh man,
it'd just be another salvage place.
Yeah. I mean, you might not look at that and say like, that's you know, Lonnie David Franklin's van there, but you wouldn't guess that. You would just look at it and say, that's just a van in a junkyard.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, with some carpet squares missing and, probably no windows and, you
know. But who cares? Cause it's a junkyard.
Yeah. It's just a junkyard, but, you know, a special kind of junkyard because they keep these separate so that they aren't inadvertently crushed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, look around for stuff like this. You might find it. I mean, who knows?
And, also, let us know if there are some infamous cars that you think other listeners should know about. Do check out our earlier podcast on that, because now we're pretty deep. We're up into the 50s, maybe.
We probably have mentioned at least 50 cars at this point, infamous cars. And I know that there's so many more out there. I mean, just another one example, the Porsche 918 that Paul Walker was killed in.
Oh, yes.
That's one right there.
Yep.
It seems like every week there's another vehicle involved in a crime or, somehow infamous. You know, a celebrity owns it or there's a death in that vehicle that is somehow, makes the news significant in some way.
And while we were exploring some of these other crime related topics, we also asked ourselves if we should cover, the folklore around ghost hitchhikers like La Llorona or something.
Yeah, we were thinking about like phantom cars and stuff
right,
like that.
Right, yeah, which are good for spooky stories, but we, of course, haven't found any evidence proving those things. And we just did a hitchhiking episode, which had some great feedback from you guys, too.
Yeah. We're both skeptics on that kind of stuff, you know, but this, I mean, these are real-world examples. These are the real deal.
Yeah.
So that's why we figured this is an kind of a fun topic to cover for Halloween.
Halloween, you know, specifically.
It seemed fitting.
Right. It seemed fitting. Now, there are other questions this brings up. If you're thinking along this line, you might be wondering, hey, Scott, hey, Ben, what about that story about the smell of a corpse that can't get out of a car? Well, check out our Urban Legends podcast where we have the conclusive answer.
Yeah. And you know what? We had said that we were going to push into maybe PG-13 area, but we didn't go into much detail in this episode. So
it might be better that we don't.
Well, we kept it light. I mean, so it remained G-rated, I think.
If you would like to hear a little bit more about auto crime, then you can check out a show Scott and I did on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, where we talk about a dangerous stretch of road in Canada known as the Highway of Tears.
Yeah, interesting story, if I do say so myself, Ben. That was it was fun to do that one with you and with Matt, of course. And man, fascinating tale. I hadn't had a chance to dig into that case very much, but now that I have, now that you have, I find it just utterly fascinating. I'm continually looking for updates on what's going on with it, and it's a great story. So if you get a chance, check out Ben's other show.
Well, it's your show, too. You're on that episode. And in the meantime, send your suggestions to us on Facebook, on Twitter. I think at this point we may still be having a debate over the Diora and the Aurora.
Yeah, the Diora and Aurora.
Yeah, right. Two great names for two divisive cars.
Yes.
And if you would like to suggest a topic for us or tell us about an infamous car or a secret junkyard, almost a graveyard, that you're aware of, please drop us a line. You can talk to us directly. We are
CarStuff at HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.